Right? Great. So thanks so much for the opportunity to talk here. I should warn you that I had less than 2 hours of sleep last night, and I missed my connection here, and also this is the first time I've talked about this, so it's not a good combination, so I apologize in advance, but hopefully we'll all get through it together. Actually, the last question was a great setup for this talk, because I'm precisely interested and what happens when you have a cell moving through a dense tissue made of other cells. That's the idea, and I'd like to try to understand that. So the first thing I'd like to point out is most of the work I'm talking today was done by my really awesome postdoc, Max, who will be at this conference later on in a month or so. I also work with some folks at Syracuse, and I'll start out with some work with Eva Maria Schutz and her collaborators. The sort of first thing I want to ask is, why would you be interested in studying cell migration in dense tissues? And so again, the first talk gives you one idea. But you can think about wound healing assays, of course, or tumor metastasis, or this is a beautiful movie taken by Eva Maria of cells. These are nuclei of cells in a zebrafish embryo. Sometimes this movie gives me trouble, so let's see if I can't play it again. And you can see that certainly these are the nuclei. These cells are confluent, meaning all of the cells are touching one another, but because only the nuclei are stained, it sort of gives you a very fluid-like feel to what you're looking at. Okay, and so that's why I'm interested in studying this. The next question, of course, is how do cells move? And so if you're thinking about cell migration, a lot of the time what folks will study is cells in isolation, either on three-dimensional scaffolds or in two dimensions or in one dimension, and there's a lot of beautiful work about how migration is different in those different environments. But I think that it's important to note this movie here is taken a confocal image, a slice through a three-dimensional zebrafish embryo. And in those dense environments, you do get cells moving past one another and changing neighbors. But if you look, these are jostling around and sort of barely sliding past one another. And it's a very sort of different sort of feel from what you see in these single cell pictures. Okay. And so I want to take a moment. My background is actually in thinking about dense granular materials. And so I wanted to sort of say, well, how would I know that a material was sort of dense and close to a glass transition? And if I wanted to know that, actually, I totally stole this from a Boulder Summer School that Dave Waits gave, a talk that Dave Waits gave at a Boulder Summer School a long time ago. And the idea is that if you look at the mean squared displacement as a function of time, if you have something which is sort of close to a glass transition, you get these velocity fields, which are sort of these big swirly vortices. Why is that? It's because some particles are sort of stuck in a slow pocket, and some particles are moving around more, and they're sort of correlated with one another. And you also see that you get sort of a sub-diffusive region here. And I went ahead and put an elastic in a fluid, which is what I guess Dave told me I shouldn't do automatically. But for these, it's true. That here, the cells aren't displacing much over this time window, and that's sort of a subdiffusive region. This is where they're jostling around really locally in their little cages, and then here is where they actually move around much more and start to actually realize they're fluid and diffuse around. Okay, so this is sort of the picture, and in these systems, the energy is global injection, either sort of thermal by a real thermal temperature, or maybe in a true granular material boundary-driven from the edges. But you see the same phenomenology if you sort of either have a thermally excited system or a system that you shear and inject energy at the boundaries. Okay? And so the point that I want to make is there's been some beautiful recent work, some by Tommy here, on MDCK cells, and this is the velocity profile in those MCDK cells. And this is very reminiscent of what you see in glassy, non-biological, non-living systems. These are some movies. This first one is a movie of a, these are both zebrafish embryo explants, and so it's just a big ball. Each one of these things is a big ball of about 10,000 cells from a zebrafish embryo. And so the first movie is what happens if you compress that object on the time. Okay, remind me later, please. A few seconds. And this one is what happens if you do something on a time scale of hours. Okay, so they should both kind of be playing at the same time. One of them sort of takes a while to get set up. Okay. Okay, and so what you should have seen on the one on the left is that the thing compresses and then releases, and you see that it sort of springs back a little bit. And on a short time scale, it's an elastic spring back effect. And on a longer time scale, you can see that these two balls of cells actually fuse together exactly as you would have two droplets of oil and water, for example. And you can do the same thing if you sort of try really hard and look at the tracking of these cells inside of these three-dimensional embryos. You see there's sort of a sub-diffusive region initially and then something that crosses over to being nearly diffusive at long time scales. And so all of these things sort of make you think, well, maybe these tissues are close to a glass transition. And maybe their dynamics are like that. And so you can ask yourself, well, this is just purely conjecture, but why might a tissue be close to a glass transition, especially if you're sort of wound healing or embryonic development? The idea is that if you need to have large-scale flows to get cells to be in certain shapes, then you need a fluid-like rheology to get that, right? But eventually, these things are going to have to support stresses and support forces, and so then they really need to solidify, and you need a solid-like rheology at the end. And so you might think that, well, maybe it makes sense that a lot of these tissues are tuned very close to that transition. It's not proof, but it's just an idea of why it could be the case. Okay, so let's think again about what we know about non-active materials. In general, if we're trying to think about the microscopic origins of the glassy behavior, a class of models that I really like are these trap and soft glassy rheology models. And the idea is simply this, that if I think about the potential energy of my system, which is just the sum of all of the energies of all of my objects that are interacting, if it's very complex and has lots of metastable states, then what I'm actually doing, if I'm sort of sitting there with not a lot of extra energy above the potential energy landscape, I'm sort of jumping from state, metastable state to metastable state, and that's how something flows, if I'm near a glass transition but not a glass. Okay, and so then you can say, well, if these energy barriers are very large compared to thermal fluctuations which are allowing me to go over those energy barriers, then I can actually use sort of like an Arrhenius or a trap rate and basically calculate the rate at which I go over these energy barriers. And so that gives me a way from deriving macroscopic properties, which is sort of the goal of these types of models. They try to describe macroscopic properties of a glassy, almost a glass, by looking at the sort of energy barriers in a system. That's the idea. Okay, and so we can also look, if we want to try to prove to ourselves that a system really is behaving glassy microscopically, one of the things that you can look at people do is called the non-Gaussian parameter, and that's on this axis. And basically what it says is if I just look at a trajectory of my cell or my particle, and I look how much it looks like a Gaussian cloud. If it looks a lot like a Gaussian cloud, then this non-Gaussian parameter is nearly zero. And that's what happens on short time scales. Okay, and then if every once in a while, so I'm sort of rattling around in a cage of my neighbors because I'm very dense, every once in a while I might make a little jump and sort of change who are my neighbors, and then I sort of jump and I go to a new place. And look, that doesn't look very Gaussian anymore. And so my non-Gaussian parameter jumps up. And then on very long time scales, they make a lot of such jumps, and then my non-Gaussian parameter goes back down. So this is a way of telling that you have a material that's behaving like a glassy solid. It's close to a glass transition on the microscopic level. Okay, and so one of the things that we did with Eva Maria is we looked at cell trajectories inside these three-dimensional embryos. And so this is actually data. This is sort of a reconstruction from confocal data showing you what happens if we try to track a cell nuclei over time. So this is just what happens over time. And these are active fluctuations. But you can see that one cell that was sitting up here right in the front field of view sort of ducks behind another cell and moves out of its cage of neighbors. And that's exactly what we're talking about when we have sort of a cage-breaking event. And so these are individual trajectories showing sort of the same sort of behavior. And you can see this is experimental data. There's some tracking issues down here. But experimental data showing a peak in the non-Gaussian parameter. And these are some simulations. This is a simulation in our best fit parameter basically our best fit simulation has a similar type of behavior. So the idea is that there's really these signatures in these systems of glassy dynamics, okay? All right. So then, what I would like to convince you is if we'd like to try to understand the rates of migration of cells in the system, then what we need to do is come up with a framework for calculating energy barriers in the system, which are collective features of the whole tissue, not of just how active a single cell is in this system. And so in order to do that, we have to have a model of some kind for calculating how much mechanical energy one given sort of configuration of the tissue has and how much mechanical energy another configuration of the tissue has. And so the way that we're going to do that here is we're going to use a shape equilibrium model. And so sometimes it's called the vertex model, but there's actually other vertex models in statistical physics, so I will call it a shape equilibrium model. But it's well studied. It's been studied for almost 10 years now. It was actually pioneered by Boris Schreiman here, and Frank Ulicher and others have made big contributions. And the idea is simply that if we have something like you talked about this morning with a cortical tension, and then we also have adhesion, and maybe we also have an additional active contractility term. We can put that all together, and if we sort of have, I'll just talk today about a two-dimensional sort of epithelial layer, and we look at a picture of the cell shapes in that two-dimensional layer, then we can estimate what the energy of the cells are based on the shapes in an energy functional like this. And this is just, it's clearly a crude approximation in the sort of this linear term, which I've called a line tension. And here is the cortical tension that we heard about this morning, and also adhesion. Both of those sit in here. There's this sort of second order term, which is either you can think about it as an elasticity or an active contractility of an actomyosin ring. You can get rid of this term if you want, and a lot of what I say still holds true today. This is an interesting term. It can either talk, it sort of is a proxy for a bulk elasticity. The other thing it can be is it can just say if I have an epithelial layer and I don't want to have too large of changes in the height of my tissue layer, and you work that out, that also gives rise to a term like this. So this is sort of very generically what comes out of any reasonable model, coarse-grained model that you would have for the mechanics of an epithelial layer. Okay, so armed with this model, then I just want to mention that if I'm interested in migration, so this is just a simulation of ours that we ran for a while, this little red cell moving around, I sort of want to tell you that, of course, in many of these systems, cell division happens, and it's important. But what I'm interested in right now, because there are some situations, there are some cell types where we know that you can get fluid-like behavior even in the absence of cell divisions, we'd like to understand what happens without cell divisions first. And then we're in luck because the only thing left is what's called a T1 transition. And so a T1 transition is just this. Imagine that I have these four cells I've highlighted. And initially, these two red cells aren't touching. And then we sort of shorten the edge between them, and we grow it in the opposite direction. And now the red cells are touching, and the green ones aren't. And what I want to sort of emphasize here is that's the only way you can get migration in a confluent 2D tissue in the absence of cell death or cell divisions. And so what that means is now we can go through a simulated tissue and calculate the probability that we can have sort of an energy barrier of a given height for any of these T1 transitions, and that's sort of the only thing that can happen. Okay, so what does a typical energy trace look like? So this is just a picture of what a simulated tissue looks like. We also do it periodically. It doesn't make much difference. As I said before, we shrink an edge, and then we grow it in the opposite direction. This is the energy as we shrink the edge. We just make it negative to be clear about how much we're shrinking an edge. This is shrinking an edge, and this is growing it. It's just to make it look nice, like an energy barrier. And we calculate the energy, and this is all numerical. And we can do this over and over again for all of these possible T1 transitions in our tissue. So that's what we're going to try to do. And we can actually do it over and over again. So this is a picture, and we calculate the energy barrier, and we're looking at statistics for that. So that's what I'm going to be showing you for the next few minutes, is simulation data like this. And this is technically challenging, by the way, so it's a really nice work by Max to do this. And so the first thing you realize is that if you plot sort of the mechanical energy, so they're all normalized, the endpoints are all normalized, and the zero points are all normalized as a function of the edge length, you sort of get roughly similar shapes And they're sort of roughly positive curvature. It shows up again and again. So maybe that's some sort of universality you'd like to understand. The next thing that you realize is that if you're looking now in energy barrier statistics, which is the next thing we want to look at, the first thing I want to say is, what did I expect to see when we did the simulation? Well, in granular materials and in foams, by the way, this model is basically a lot like a foam model that people have used. It's a generalized foam model, if you will. So if you do shearing of a foam, what you generally see is a power law distribution. This happens to be stress drops, but the energy barrier statistics are the same because it's a power law. And then there's sort of an exponential cutoff at the end. Okay, and sort of, I'm not going to go into a lot of detail about this, but I think people in this field are coalescing around the idea that maybe the reason that you should expect this is that you're injecting energy globally from the boundaries, and it turns out that you sort of have these special spots in the material that are sort of just on the edge of failure, and this is a system which is tuned for avalanches, okay, and so you sort of are sitting right there, and you have basically this sort of critical type behavior. Okay, so that's sort of an idea that people have as to why you have a power law. And there's plenty more I could say about that, but I won't. Instead, what I'd like to show you is that if you look at energy barrier statistics from this tissue, notice that this is a log plot on this side, but this isn't a log. This is just a regular axis. And so this is an exponential distribution for the energy barriers. And so I found this a little bit surprising. And what I'd like to say is that I think that it's because here energy is injected locally, and instead of having this sort of this global thing where we're picking out special spots that fail, we're actually testing all possible spots, which is what cells do because they can choose to move at any point. It's not injected globally. Okay, so that's the first thing. And I'll come back to this exponential tail because that's exciting from a theoretical perspective. I'll come back. Okay. Then the other thing we can look at, which is, I think, sort of a plea for some experiments, because I don't know of any like this yet, is that we notice that there is a strong dependence of the energy barrier on the topology. In other words, if I look at the number of nearest neighbors that cells, let me call them S1 and S2, have, if I have more neighbors, then I have a higher energy barrier, and if I have fewer neighbors, I have a lower energy barrier. And this is just showing you the distributions of, because of course there's a distribution in a packing like this once you minimize the energy, of how many neighbors of different kinds there are. And this is again that exponential distribution, which is the final result, and this is just showing you how it's broken down for cells that have different amounts of neighbors. Okay, and so this should be experimentally accessible, and so I would love for somebody to test this. Okay, so yay, I'd like for somebody to talk to me about it if they want. So next what we'd like to do is we'd like to try to understand where these simulation results come from. And so the first thing that we did is we looked at a very simple mean field model. What we noticed is that most of the energy change during one of these T1 transitions is pretty localized to the four cells that are just sitting there around the T1 transition. And so if we just make a mean field model where we assume each of these four cells involved has exactly six neighbors, and six neighbors is a topological constraint imposed by the Gauss-Bonnet theorem, so it just has to be the case that on average the number of neighbors in the system is six, so we have a mean field model where it's six. And then you could say, okay, well, I'm going to assume that they're all regular. I'm going to go a step further and assume that they're all regular polygons. Then you can actually use this mean field model to calculate everything, and you can analytically calculate what the shape of the energy barrier is, and you get something that looks like this nice black line here. And so basically the idea is that this energy barrier shape just comes out from sort of the local, there's nothing much more interesting than the local dynamics here. Okay, so that's good. We understand it. It's maybe not collective and exciting, but we understand it. I think that sort of a slightly more interesting feature is, what's the origin of this exponential tail? And in this system, I think it's kind of cool. I think it's sort of a happy accident that if you have an energy which is quadratic in edge lengths, and so you can sort of see that's what you get from this term. But actually, it's kind of interesting, even if you get rid of this term, this constraint tends to impose it anyway. I won't go into all the details, but this is pretty generic, that you get an energy which is quadratic in edge lengths. And if I have a packing, a tessellation of space in 2D, and I look I sort of minimize this energy functional, or even a foam energy functional, I tend to find a Gaussian distribution of edge lengths. That's just what tends to happen. That's maybe not so surprising, that the lengths of edges between all of this system, this disordered system, is Gaussian. So I have something like that. And then exponential is just there. Okay, so the exponential distribution maybe isn't any more interesting than that. And that's what our simulation results tend to agree with when we look at the origin of that exponential distribution. Okay, so that's nice. We have maybe an idea of where that comes from. We can also try to figure out what's going on with this topological dependence. And so what we do now is we say, okay, we're not going to restrict anymore what these two S cells are. We're going to let them have a free number of neighbors. And then we're going to calculate the size of the energy barrier as a function of the sort of number of neighbors that each of these two cells has. And then we get this red curve. And so what I want you to notice is that without any fit parameters at all, none, this sort of goes through the data, gets roughly the right order of magnitude and everything based on the energy functional. But it doesn't quite work as you get to sort of these fewer neighbor cells. And that's because these events become more collective. And therefore, our mean field model breaks down over there. So it sort of, we get the order of magnitude right, but not the curvature right with the mean field model. So I think we sort of understand roughly what's going on here, but there's some interesting collective effects down here. So that's sort of the picture for that. Now what we'd like to try to understand, of course, because what we're really interested in is migration rates, right? So what we'd like to do next is we'd like to say, okay, I have this distribution of energy barriers. How can I go from that for a prediction of what I expect for migration rates? And we again take inspiration from these trap and soft glassy rheology models, which basically say that if I have a potential energy landscape that looks something like this, and I have an energy barrier, I'm going to assume that there's some sort of random variable, which I'll call epsilon. People have called this an effective temperature. It's definitely not that. But it's supposed to model shape fluctuations in cells. It's supposed to be like a random fluctuation of cell shape that allows the cell to explore this potential energy landscape. But we know from other work that we've done in our group that that's probably not enough to overcome the very large energy barriers that are there in these tissues. Because right, if I had a foam that looked exactly like this, it would be very, very difficult to get rearrangements in the foam. The energy barriers are very high. And so what you actually need to overcome energy barriers in a system like this is a directed cell motion. And we've seen that in a couple other places. So we put it in here, and we put it in here in the sort of simplest possible way. We say there's sort of, as a function of time, we sort of allow ourselves to go up this energy barrier landscape at a constant rate. And so this sort of looks like a bit that you might have in soft glassy rheology when you're shearing the system at a constant shear. But the idea is that we can then write down a master equation which predicts the probability of either staying in a trap or exiting the trap at any given time. So this is sort of a standard thing you can do with these types of models. And then we can make predictions based on evaluating this, this equation. And if and only if there is an exponential distribution of energy barriers, then you can carry it through analytically. Okay, and so we've actually seen that we have an exponential distribution of energy barriers, so there's a lot of beautiful things you can do, and you can do them analytically. And so this is just a picture of sort of what the analytics tell you, that you can first estimate the probability that a cell sort of stays in its cage as a function of time. So that's how long it takes to make a rearrangement. And you can see that, and remember that this epsilon just tells me about the sort of fluctuations in the cell shape that allow me to explore this potential energy landscape. And so what you see is that, of course, at very short times, I'm always in my cage, I can't move. And if I'm very close to the glass transition, then it takes a very long time for me to exit my cage, because this is, of course, a logarithmic scale. And so I see that I get something like this. And moreover, I can also say that if I can look at what happens now for the relaxation time, which we'll define as when this function sort of decays to 1 over e of its initial value. And so we can see how long is the relaxation time in this model. And this, I know, is a very busy plot. This black line is what happens if there's none of this cell polarization. So in the absence of sort of a dedicated driving force, this thing has sort of a glass transition right here. So on this axis is the cell fluctuations. And then these different lines are saying, okay, what if I have directed cell motion on top of those fluctuations? And the thing I want you to take away from this slide is that what it tells us is how to go, if we have a prediction for an energy barrier, it tells us how to, if you're an experimentalist, how to predict how long your cell will stay there before it changes neighbors. And we can do that as a function of the cell's number of nearest neighbors, and we make a lot of predictions like this. The other thing we can do is with a function like this, we can just take a random walker that has the statistics of something like this, that sort of stays in place for a while and then makes a probability of jump after a certain amount of time. So this model also predicts mean squared displacements as a function of time for random walkers, and it also predicts this non-Gaussian parameter as a function of time. And remember, the peak in this non-Gaussian parameter tells you basically what the relaxation time is. It tells you how long it is before you break out of that first cage and move on to the next part. Okay, and so this is something that looks a lot like we've seen in several different experiments, both in 2D and 3D, and the same trend you see as the mean squared displacement as a function of time. But I'll say that this is sort of cheating because we sort of, that's the whole point of the model, is to reproduce this, okay? But this is telling us that we're really having an idea of what microscopic energy barrier statistics, which is this exponential distribution, gives rise to this type of behavior. So that's the picture. So I think then the next thing I wanted to mention is just a little bit of work in progress. I think the next obvious question to ask is, well, how do single cell properties influence the rate of migration? Right, that's what you might want to know for these wound healing experiments or for embryonic development. And so what you can do is you can look at, as a function of model parameters, we've non-dimensionalized this model now, so there's only two parameters. There's a generalized contractility, and then there's a generalized line tension. And as a function of these two parameters, we can look now at the metastable states and the energy barriers between them. So there's actually a really nice paper by Frank Ulliker and collaborators asking about the ground states of a model like this. In other words, like, what is the very minimum energy state? I recommend the paper. There's a lot of really cool ground states to these types of systems. But for purposes of thinking about biology, what you're probably interested in, although the ground states give you an idea of what sort of phase space you're in, what you're really interested in are energy barriers and metastable states. And so that's what we're calculating here for these different parameters. And then you can start to ask questions like, well, if I have a cell that has an increased contractility, does that mean it will move faster or slower, right? Or questions like that. One thing that shows up is that there's sort of a very robust exponential tail. So you might worry that this exponential distribution that I showed you earlier depended on the parameter regime I happen to be in, and that's not the case. So that's good. It's very robust. The other thing you can do is something that I don't think we still understand fully, but there's this really nice scaling collapse. So on this axis is the generalized, this axis is the, so what this is it's the average energy barrier height. And this, on this axis, it's scaled by this contractility, which is sort of this thing that sits in front of the p squared term, which is the perimeter squared. And on this axis is the a line tension term. And so you can see that there's sort of two regimes. It's sort of, there's a scaling collapse, and there's something that sort of behaves almost like a coarsening type of behavior here, and then there's something that doesn't behave like that. This is sort of an interesting, we're unsure as to what this means for the behavior of cells in a tissue. But I think it's kind of interesting that it collapses. And the last thing that we're sort of starting to think about now is what happens if I have an abnormal cell, a cell that's mechanically different, and it's embedded in a matrix of cells that are all the same, right? Because you might say, well, what if I had one cell that was sort of precancerous, right? Does it migrate faster or does it migrate slower based on the energy barriers that it experiences inside the dense tissue? And so we're working on that. I mean, preliminarily, it seems that a softer cell has lower energy barriers. The interesting thing is whether something which has higher contractility, does that have higher or lower energy barriers? And so that's something we're working about right now. Also, we can make predictions for maybe even what cell shapes should look like inside these dense tissues, because, of course, cell shapes are generated as a collective effect inside these dense tissues. So that's something that we can look at. Okay. So many tissue types show evidence of being close to a glass transition. And I think that makes sense, and I think it's a fundamentally interesting way of thinking about these tissues as being materials that are sort of have this tuning parameter. For dense tissues, we've developed a framework for estimating energy barriers to cell rearrangements, which I argue is really an important thing to think about if you're interested in migration in those systems. One of the points that I wanted to make is that I and a lot of other folks here are interested in self-propelled particle models, and those are good, but I don't think that they work very well at these high densities because the overlaps that you get are unphysical, and they really, I don't think, give you a good picture of what the energy barriers really are. So even if it turns out that this model that I just showed you, when we check it very carefully with experiments, isn't exactly right, I think you have to do something like that where you take into account what the true energy barriers are in these confluent tissues, because that confluence imposes a lot of extra constraints on the system that are important. We find that in the system, the energy barriers are exponentially distributed, and we find that regularly, that the energy barriers depend strongly on a cell's number of nearest neighbors, and so if anybody wants to test that, we'd love it. And we also have some new data. There's lots of stuff going on with that. We develop an SGR or trap-like model to translate those energy barriers into rates of cell migration, for comparison to experiments, and sort of the qualitatively they match really well, although we need some more experiments to test it quantitatively. And we also are looking at how changing single cell properties changes migration rates with an eye towards things like cancer and cell sorting, things like that. Okay, so these are the couple of papers that have this work in it. I want to thank you for your attention and draw you again to Max, who did a large amount of this work.
Very nice talk. Two questions. One, can you say a little bit about the dynamics in your model? You told us the energy, but nothing about the dynamics. And then, can you tell whether that'll give you the rheological response that you showed us for the ball of embryo cells?
Great question. The first question is what are the dynamics? And the dynamics are literally that we just, so there's two types of things we do. One is we just take every possible T1 spot in the whole tissue, we shrink one edge and grow the other. And we think that that keeps us close to the potential energy landscape surface and gives us an idea of the energy barrier there. Now, when I showed you that picture of the cell migrating, which is something that we're very interested in pushing forward on, what we do is we sort of make a T1 transition at the front and then choose a random edge in the back to make another T1 transition, and we keep doing that to allow it to move. But the data that I showed you yet, I don't think that dynamics, because what we're really doing is we're really getting a feel for the energy barriers, and that will only tell you about, you need something like SGR or to go from an energy landscape to dynamics. You actually need something else. It's not going to give you dynamics by itself. So once you have the statistics of the energy barriers, which can be informed by simulations, you can take an SGR-like model and calculate G prime or G double prime and things like that. Now, one interesting thing is those experiments I showed you are dominated by the surface tension of the tissue in a lot of cases, and so it's hard to get experiments that explore the bulk rheology of that tissue instead of sort of being dominated by surface effects, which are interesting in this type of model and we've studied, but I think that sort of, I would be interested in talking more about that, I think is the real answer.
So if I understand your model correctly, you're essentially modeling your cells as similar to shear bubbles, including the SGR model. How is your model different from actually that particular model? More precisely, how would you incorporate spatial and temporal correlations of your active motion into this kind of model?
Great. First, your question is how is it different from a foam model? So there are several big differences. One is that for a foam model, for most foam models that are like that, you have the energy functional has to do with the mean curvature, and you get things like true coarsening. There's no p squared term. So that p was a perimeter. I don't know if I said that often enough in this talk. P is a perimeter, A is an area. And so you don't really have a p squared term in a foam model. Also, you don't really have an A minus A naught term. So although the sort of shapes are kind of similar to what you see in a foam, the energy resulting from those shapes is very different. The second point is that you're exactly right. In a sheared foam, you have this global driving force. And that's what you do for shearing one of these systems is you literally like take the sides and you go to it, right? And here we're trying to explore what I think is a different physics, which is that if energy is injected locally, instead of when you do this, you're really allowing the system to select certain parts of the foam that want to break. And here we're forcing to say, well, if an individual stall tries hard enough, it can break at any point. And the statistics there are very different, I would argue. And then the final point
I would agree, yes.
And then the last point is I think that sort of the last answer to the question is if we really want to get dynamics for these systems, I think that we need, I don't think you want something exactly like SGR where you have the stress term that's sort of causing things to go over energy barriers. You have to explicitly include like a local piece that has a little bit different statistics than the stress term that comes out in foams. And so we've included something in our model to try to do that. I'm not sure it's right. So I think it's something that we need to sort of test carefully with experiments to check and see.
In the analogy to the glass transition, you introduced a noise or a fluctuation. You called it epsilon, and it basically controls the distance to the glass transition.
Yes.
I was wondering, do you have access to this kind of noise in experiment?
So it's a great question. This epsilon has been sort of estimated from what are called membrane ruffling experiments in cells. And so people will look, they'll assume a tension along an interface, and they'll look at the fluctuations perpendicular to the interface, assuming that there's some noise spectrum which isn't generated thermally but is generated by active fluctuations. And they'll use that to extract this epsilon-like parameter. Now, I don't know if that, I mean, it's definitely a noise parameter, and it's definitely going to cause fluctuations in sort of the center of mass of cells in this system. But I don't know if that's exactly the right temperature to, you know, or temperature-like term to measure. And also, as I sort of pointed out, I've also included this other type of active thing, which is a directed activity. And what I really think probably needs to be done is that you actually, to really solve this problem correctly, you actually just want to solve SGR again, but have a noise with a memory kernel and do it properly. But that will be very hard to do. So that's why we didn't do it yet.
So one question is just for my own edification. You said the only way for migration to happen in this system is through T1 transitions. That's for a single cell moving through a monolayer. But if I had, say, if I locked every pair of cells together, that could happen as well, right?
Right. And then, I mean, the way I would argue it then is that you have a chunk, a rigid object, that is a big cell-like object that is undergoing T1 transitions.
So, great. So then my next question is, if I wanted to take some data and analyze it and look for these things, not knowing how large of a chunk to choose, if I merely found all nearest neighbors and looked for the T1 transitions between every pair, then T1 transitions between every four, and T1 transitions between every six, eight, whatever, would we be able to renormalize your theory so that, I don't know, we could learn something about
that's a really good
what
question.
Really happens?
I mean, especially motivated by the previous talk, right? You saw this chunk of things that were going through a dense material. So we've started to think about that a little bit. I would say for things like that sort of a lot of wound healing assays, you actually don't tend to see, it's usually where you see these structures that are coherently moving through are in development. That's where I'm used to seeing them, or in cancer metastasis actually, right? And so I think that in certain types of assays, you can just get away from that because you don't tend to have those types of coordinated structures. But I think it's something that I would be interested in. I don't know if our theory could do that. I imagine it could, but I haven't thought about it carefully.
So in connection with the of the energy landscape with the kinetics you're talking about. So I'm wondering when you this is not a clear connection. So the more clear connection seems to be looking at free energy landscapes. In other words, the entropy. I mean, you haven't mentioned too much about the entropy. It must play an important role here because in the glass, it's actually the entropy of these competing metastable states which give the glass transition. So I'm wondering what your thoughts.
So it's an excellent point. So what about entropy in the system? And so I would say there's a couple comments to be made. The first I would make is that, of course, when you're talking about going from energy barriers to an SGR or trap-like model, you've sort of taken the concept of entropy and put it into how you explore the metastable basins, right? You've sort of put it in a different place than you would for a free energy theory in some sense. I would say that sort of my feeling about these systems is that their ability to get out of one of these sort of states where they're trapped in these dense tissues, the energy barriers are large and they are different depending on which path I take. And so I think in this system, unlike say a hard sphere glass or something where there's no energy, I would say the energy is an extremely important contribution in this system. And to first order, you know, in the absence of other evidence, a reasonable assumption is to say, okay, I'm going to assume that I can do this calculation for the energies, and then I have to ask myself, how do I explore? Because then I can think about there being an entropy of sort of the metastable states, and then there's also some sort of, if you want to call it like a vibrational entropy within those states, if the energy barriers are large and take a long time to overcome. This is sort of a standard thing that you do in glassy systems to the entropies. You divide it up into the number of metastable states that gives you some entropy, and then sort of the entropy within those states. And so I would say that this theory is in that spirit in which you say, okay, I'm going to say, what are the probabilities of me exiting these metastable states? And then all of the entropy sits in sort of what are the sort of densities of those, you know, how many of those metastable states do I have?
Entropy at all relevant if KT is zero?
What? Well, but I think, I mean, but you do have active fluctuation. So I guess it's a great question. Right. I mean, maybe other people that have thought a lot more about this will have something more interesting to say.
It's relevant because it represents the second law of thermodynamics of both the system and a reservoir with which it's in thermal equilibrium. You translate the second law of thermodynamics to something involving free energy. Yeah. But this, you're not talking about thermal fluctuations, you're talking about active fluctuations, and I don't think that you could have something like noise that looks like Boltzmann factors to give you your transport, but I think that then introducing entropy a little bit.
Well, the reason I didn't want to say that is because I actually think that there's lots of questions like surface tension in these systems where you actually want to take an ensemble average, and even though it's not entropy in the standard thermodynamic sense, you are trying to make an argument, if you're talking about surface tension in these systems, about the ensemble of metastable states and how you're exploring them. And you make some, to make calculations about like surface tension, you have to say that I've sort of, with uniform density, explore metastable states. So I guess what I would argue is I agree with you to some extent, but there, I think that if you're interested in fluid-like behavior in the system, then you have to say something about how sort of, are there certain metastable states that are, you know, pockets of metastable states in this complex entropy landscape that are more populated by the dynamics? Do you see what I'm saying?
Discussion to carry on.
Yes, sorry.
It's a fundamental one. Abhi?
Well, okay, it's more kind of a comment. I work on networks mostly, so elastic networks, and there is something that we've been working on which draws some kind of parallels with what you told us today. It's more based on rheology on these networks in which the network remodels itself, but as it remodels, with time the remodeling becomes increasingly slow because it finds itself in deeper and deeper energy wells, so which tends to give rise finally to a relaxation which proceeds logarithmically in time. But there, indeed, there is a dynamical aspect associated with that, that you have an idea about how, what governs the rate of escape from these barriers. That if it's sitting in a potential well, what governs the, what's the rate at which it can escape over these barriers? So I was wondering that maybe, well, afterwards I would like to just discuss with you about how this relates with your system.
Yeah. That sounds interesting, yeah.
Okay, so I like the model, but it looks like you have a particle that, like, it's moving in a kind of quench energy landscape, right? And I suppose that if you think of a tissue, the energy landscape is fluctuating at quite a lot.
Yes.
And it's fluctuating, in fact, that time scales related to the same time scale associated to leaving your mm-hmm. trap, right?
Yes.
So the dynamics has to enter into that game, I presume, right? So
it's an excellent question. So I've worried about exactly this question, which is that if I have all of these other cells which are moving around at a rate that's quick enough, then there is no sort of base state for me to calculate my mechanical energy with respect to. And what I'll say is that there's a couple of interesting things that you can look for in an experiment to ask yourself, is a given experiment in a regime where I should be worried about a model like this? And I think the first one is that all of these sort of models, regardless of exactly the details, say that if I have a cell that's sort of in, if I have a system that's in a mechanically stable minimum, then the cells sort of really like to be aspect ratio 1, and they all sort of basically look like these nice polygons. And then as I transition between states, I get things that are they sort of squeeze past their neighbors, they sort of squish, right? And then they sort of expand out because expanding out to aspect ratio 1 is another sort of favorable in this mechanical energy landscape. So what I would say is that there's an experimental way for you to know whether this type of model is relevant for an experimental system, which is to look at the sort of time spent in these sort of pancake shapes, because those are not sort of those are sort of transition states in the model, relative, and how many cells, because you're right, this is going on all over. In other words, do I have a lot of pancakey cells all right near one another, and so there is no mechanical energy stable spot? Or do I actually sort of see one cell move in a region that sort of all of the rest of them are aspect ratio 1, and then maybe one moves over here? So I think that there are tissues which are in the regime where you have to worry about that, and I think there are tissues that aren't.